Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 12, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:02 p.m. Present, we have Vice Chair Wright. Representative Carpenter is on his way through the door. Representative Johnson, Representative Allard, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Shaw. I'd like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to silence or turn off your cell phones. Staff assisting us today are our regulars, Annie Goodenough with House Records and Talia Ames with the LIO. And Buddy Witt, my committee aide, is here for assistance. We have five items on today's agenda. The committee will continue to work on bills previously heard and take public testimony. Following an initial presentation of House Bill 190, sponsored by Representative Carpenter. Any members have any comments that would like to say before we start? Okay, none. Senate Bill 103, sponsored by Senator Dunbar, was heard on February 29th. A call for amendments was made, and amendments were considered at a second hearing on March 7th. Two questions were raised by committee members during the hearing, so we held the bill until today to get those questions answered. Present to answer questions today are Claire Radford and Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law. I'd like to welcome Representative Story to the committee. Representative Johnson and Representative Carpenter had questions about the bill, and would you like to pose those questions? Either of you would like to pose those questions to either Legislative Legal or the Department of Law today. Representative Carpenter. Brief and easy. Record, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, through the chair, my question was I was just reminded of my question by your very able staff member. I am just trying to find the section of the bill that was that I needed to reference in regards to the grand jury question that I posed, which is, so this is on page 2, lines, looks like probably 14 through 16 or 17. Records and information collected through the peer support counseling program are not subject to discovery or subpoena in connection with a civil or criminal proceeding. And then it says a subsection does not apply to information that is acquired, and then some caveats there. So the question that I have would be, would information collected during the peer support counseling program be something that would not be something that a grand jury could subpoena?
Is this a question to Casey Schroeder or Claire Rapper from either legal or the Department of Law?
Or yeah, that is a question. I think we should probably go to Department of Law for that question.
Okay. Could we have the Department of Law come forward, please, introduce yourself if you wouldn't mind? Just go ahead. Only one of you need to take a seat. Leave the seat. Thank you. And just put yourself on the record, if you would, please.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter. Information received due to counseling with the peer counseling would not be admissible at a grand jury because the grand jury can only hear evidence that would be admissible at trial. And this language on page 2, lines 9 through 17 clearly states that that evidence would not be admissible at trial. However, if it falls under one of the exceptions, then it would be possible to get that information before a grand jury, but not unless an exception applies.
Representative Carpenter, follow up?
No, I've heard enough. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is also to the Department of Law. I was curious about mandatory reporting. If in the process of peer counseling something comes up, does this keep a mandatory reporter from reporting? I think I found the answer in the bill, but I'd like to hear it on the record. So.
Through the chair to Representative Johnson. A mandatory reporter would still need to report under one of several exceptions in the bill. On the bottom of page 2, line 31, information that is required by law to be reported, that's not confidential under the bill. It would still have to be reported. And then on page 3, line 1, information relating to the abuse of a child or a vulnerable adult, so that exception would also apply. And then if the person disclosing is actually the perpetrator. Page 3, line 2, any admission of criminal conduct, that exception could apply. So there are several exceptions in the bill that would require a mandatory reporter to still report. And so there are no concerns from the department of law with respect to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Casey. Now I understand why you're always have that law book with you everywhere you go. Any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none. Representative Wright.
Chair Shaw, I move Senate Bill 103, Work Order 33, LS0565-alpha, as amended, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you, Representative Wright. Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to complete the committee report. Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate Bill 12, sponsored by Senator Keel, was introduced to the committee late last session. We brought the bill back on March 5th to have a refresher course on the bill and answer committee questions. On March 7th, we introduced a committee substitute. An amendment deadline was announced, and my office received only one amendment, and it's mine. I move Amendment 1.
Objection for purpose of the discussion.
I'll ask my committee aide, Buddy Witt, to come forward to the presenter's table, explain the amendment. I'd like to also note that while I am introducing the amendment for consideration, I haven't made a decision on whether I'm going to support my own amendment or not. It has, as the chair of the committee, I sponsored this amendment. It's because of the policy discussion, and I wanted it on the record if I could, please. If you would, Buddy, introduce yourself and help us with the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to the chair. And as you mentioned, Chair, this discussion began with the bill sponsor pointing out to you and I that there was a fix that was needed. The CS was introduced to repair that fix, and the committee's working document right now has and does not allow anyone on the Central Registry of Sex Offenders to apply for the address confidentiality program. The amendment being offered is to spur discussion. As we mentioned during the discussion on the committee substitute, there may be a scenario in which someone, and I'll just make up a scenario for the committee's consideration. You have an individual who is on the registry. Let's say that this individual is 3 months away from being what we term off paper, completely done with all of the their sentencing guidelines, and the they're about to be done. And this person, let's say, is now a victim of domestic abuse, and they are in fear for their personal safety. And the address confidentiality program may be something that this person wants to enter into in order to protect themselves or their family members or both. With this amendment, there would be then an opportunity, should that or a similar situation arise, there would be an opportunity for that person to possibly enter the program. And so I'll explain what this amendment does. The first thing that this amendment does is it adds a subsection under AS 1865-087, which is the statute that deals with Central Registry of Sex Offenders. And it adds some language in this already existing section that says, and I'll read, sex offenders or child kidnappers' address is confidential and not subject to public disclosure if the sex offender or child kidnapper is enrolled in the address confidentiality program under AS 44-21022, the program that is established with this bill should it pass. The second piece of that is that it deletes, on page 3, lines 1 through 3, deletes the phrase, not required to register as a sex offender or child kidnapper under AS 12.63 or similar law of another jurisdiction. That's a conforming change, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And then the second major change is it inserts a new subsection that establishes the method in which a person who is on the sex offender registry may be able to enter into the address confidentiality program. And this gets more a little bit more into the meat and the detail. And I will read an individual who has a duty to register under AS 1263-010 may petition the court for an order that the individual is eligible to enroll or remain enrolled in the program. A copy of the petition must be served to the Department of Public Safety or on the Department of Public Safety. If the Department of Public Safety does not file a response within 45 days after the service of the petition, the court may grant the petition without further proceedings, subject to the requirements of C of this subsection. The court may issue an order finding that an individual who has a duty to register under AS 1263-010 is eligible to enroll or remain enrolled in the program if it finds by clear and convincing evidence that the individual's safety interest in keeping the individual's address confidential outweighs the public safety interest in making the individual's address public as provided, and it cites the two statutes. Then there are conforming changes, technical changes. Because of the added sections, we delete one sentence that would be counter to what the amendment is attempting to do, and then there are additional conforming and technical changes with the rest of the amendment. And so by passing this, a person would apply. There would have to be clear and convincing evidence, and if the court either takes no action or for 45 days or by my reading of this submits a positive response to the petition, then that person may be able, may be granted access to the program. We also have, Mr. Chair, we also have Lisa Purinton from the Department of Public Safety who can speak more to the department's position and also how they treat this operationally, how they would view this amendment and the underlying bill. And that's all that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. And part of the reason I brought this amendment forward was for the edification of the committee is for policy discussion, just so we can get a better overview or better insight to what the bill was all about. And this just sort of gives us a better clarification. Do we have any questions from any committee members? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. Are we going to be hearing from DPS now?
We can if you'd like.
Yes, I
she's
appreciate
online.
That.
So, okay. Lisa Purinton from Department of Public Safety, are you? I don't have you online. Are you in the audience? Take an at ease. Okay, we're back on the record, and I pulled down the queue. It looks like we have Sarah Stanley from Anchorage with the Assistant Attorney General and for the Department of General Counsel for the Department of Public Safety. Can you give us a follow-up to the issue that was brought up with the amendment, if you remember?
To the chair, would you mind repeating the question?
Could you take an Eddie's? Back on the record, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. And my question had to do with the amendment and was it brought forth from the Department of Public Safety or what is your position on the amendment?
Through the chair, Sarah Stanley. Counsel for DPS, through the chair to Representative Story. I can give some legal analysis about what this amendment does, but I would like to leave it to DPS themselves to sort of give a policy position. So if you have any questions about what this amendment does, maybe more in a good position for those questions.
Okay, no problem. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to the bill sponsor. Senator Keel, could you explain if this is a friendly amendment and where the idea for this amendment came from, if you're aware?
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Carrick, I want to thank the committee for this open, this transparent conversation on this policy call. This is not our typical way, and it is very much appreciated. This amendment is friendly. and I appreciate it. I think that this would be my preferred way to address the issue in the bill. And before I talk in a little more detail about it, I want to say that that this really is an open policy discussion. The chair has expressed that, and I'm just deeply appreciative. If the committee goes the other way, that is also quite acceptable. So getting specifically to the amendment, the origin of this notion came from my service on the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. It is a topic that when you get into the details of it, you want to take your brain out and wash it. But these things happen. They happen in our country and in our state. And so there are people who are placed into and forced into through addiction and through the acts of horrible people doing things that are criminal, doing things that are awful. Nothing in this amendment diminishes those acts or the consequences of those acts. When someone escapes, when someone gets free and is in true fear for their life or the lives of their children, this would give that rare exceptional situation access to this, the protection of this registry. And so I just, if the chair will indulge me, want to point, as Mr. Witt said, to that text on that first full paragraph on page 2, the individual would have to go to court. They would have to hire a lawyer. The Department of Public Safety would get a copy of the petition and have the opportunity for a state attorney to come in and say, no, we disagree. This person is a risk who, and their whatever threat they perceive is not sufficient. And a judge would have to make that call, not by a little bit, not by a preponderance of the evidence, by a clear and convincing standard. That's a high bar to clear. And that's quite deliberate and quite appropriate. And so that would allow the person to access the registry. It's important to note two other things that it would not do. It would not take them off the registry for the purposes of the Department of Public Safety knowing where they are. And if, as Mr. Witt said, Mr. Chairman, that person is still being monitored by the Department of Corrections, their PO would know where they are. This does not hide their address from law enforcement in any way.
Thank you. A follow-up? Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm not entirely sure who this question's to, but it's a legal one in nature. I'm wanting to know what an example of what clear and convincing evidence would look like that would indicate that an individual required to be registered on the sex offender registry, that their interest in personal safety would outweigh the public interest in making the registrant's address public. What would clear and convincing evidence need to look like?
Senator Keel, do you feel that's a question you could answer, or you want somebody with law or public safety to come on board with that?
Mr. Chairman, I could certainly read the description of clear and convincing from Alaska's criminal statutes, but it might be best, I believe there is a representative from the court system here, to have them describe how a judge would reach that decision.
All right. Casey Schroeder, would you like to come forward and help us with that? Or Nancy Mead? Okay, Nancy Mead, if you'd like to come forward and place yourself on the record, if, answer that if you could.
Especially because I'm not finding it in the definitions. I know it's here.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair, to Representative Carpenter, I believe, asked the question. Clear and convincing evidence is a standard that courts are used to, though it's very sort of difficult to put a percentage on it. I'm sure you're aware that preponderance of the evidence would be 51%. Beyond a reasonable doubt, people put somewhere in the 90s. That's for a criminal conviction. Clear and convincing evidence is established as somewhere in there without exactitude. And I guess I would say that, you know, maybe it's 70% certainty, but it is not something that is typically defined with the statute attempts to define it, but it's kind of compared to everything else you look at. How pretty clearly are you convinced that this is the case? The sorts of things that I can anticipate coming up at one of these hearings might be the person who's required to register as a sex offender might factually try to establish to the court that they are rehabilitated. They might provide others to say that their risk to public safety has been minimized because of treatment, for example, that they might have gone through. On the other side, you might have folks say, the Department of Law, for example, or witnesses for that matter, say that the importance of protecting the public by having people's names on a sex offender registry that is available to the public is a very important right, and the judge would be trying to weigh how, for example, afraid that sex offender slash victim of domestic violence is and how valid that fear is against the very strong public policy as displayed in the statutes and legislative history and having people's names who committed certain offenses made public for a certain period of time. So that would be the balance that the court would have to consider.
Follow up. So the purpose of the sex offender registry wasn't just for law enforcement. It was also for general public knowledge. And it seems to me that if we put this amendment in place that says if you are required to be on the sex offender registry and you become a victim, there is some level of evidence that would allow your physical location to be excluded from all of the other non-victims, the general public, that has a right or is able to see where most sex offenders are registered and where their address is. And all I'm trying to understand for the general public and for those people that would be trying to understand this is what is it that would elevate that victim status above the public's status to know? That's what I'm trying to understand.
And Senator Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to Representative Carpenter, the language of the amendment makes clear that it is that victim offender, their safety interest. So it is the risk to their life or physical safety, not their privacy interest, not their desires, their safety interest that is weighed against the public's safety interest.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up?
Continue. I don't know I don't know how to weigh or how to gauge what somebody's lifestyle choices might be, or life choices, let's just put it that way, that gets them onto a sex offender registry. But it seems to be down a dangerous path would not be what we would choose for them. Let's put it that way. Does that mean that their choices put them in danger of retaliation within whatever it is, lifestyle choices that they have, that any sex offender could make that argument, and therefore their name would be on a list, but their location would not? That's what I think the can of worms that we're opening here with this amendment would be. All it takes is for somebody to go to a judge and say, hey, here's the proof. I'm in danger. I'm in physical danger. And then I have found a loophole from having my address listed on a sex offender registry. I don't know if that's a question or just a statement.
Representative Garrick.
Through the chair I'm not exactly sure who's the best to answer this question. Kind of a general question. Is there a number of sex trafficking victims in Alaska who end up being prosecuted as a sex offender or a child kidnapper? Is that a population that is potentially affected by this amendment?
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in answer to Representative Carrick's question, one of the things the council is working on is to have a clear definition of trafficking victim so that we can work on the services needed to rescue more people and to get them into safe and independent living. So unfortunately, I don't have strong data for you. I don't have a number I can cite to you. In conversations with folks in the executive branch, we believe the number of people who might potentially take advantage of this is quite small. But unfortunately, I cannot give the committee a hard number.
Follow up?
Thank you, and through the chair. But to the courts, to Ms. Mead, the assumption in this amendment is that someone's safety would have to be the interest impacted with clear and convincing evidence indicating that in all likelihood they had been a victim or are potentially going to be a victim of additional violent crimes. So I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of, is this amendment sort of centric to people who have also been victimized by probably some of the same crimes listed here?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, although I can't answer that with certainty, I would say that, of course, this only applies to individuals who are required to register on the sex offender registry. Typically, people are required after spending a certain amount of time, sometimes substantial time, imprisoned, and then only 30 years later, perhaps 15 years later, do they come up with the issue that they have been a victim of a crime involving domestic violence, stalking, or sexual assault. I think that might be why the sponsor said that this would be somewhat rare, that people have those two things coexisting, so that they are a victim after having victimized somebody in a serious sex offense. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but it is not the sort of thing we would anticipate handling a lot. I would add that these, as Representative Carpenter implied, would be quite difficult questions for the court. It would be hard to decide given the fundamental the compelling state interest that there is in protecting the public via the sex offender registry to look at the person's safety and decide which wins out. I mean, if it's a close call, the petitioner does not win because it must be clear and convincing evidence. But these would not be routine or lightly taken petitions or proceedings.
Yeah, to the chair, I guess I would say that in the unlikely scenario where someone checks these boxes, it's probably a good idea to have the protections in place. And also in acknowledgement that while the scenario sort of alluded to by Ms. Mead is a little different than what I'm imagining, I could easily imagine a scenario where someone is brought into sex trafficking because they are a victim of sex trafficking and are coerced in that industry, could be a part of perpetuating that sex trafficking. We've heard stories that that is the case, and that wouldn't preclude them from being charged later as a sex offender. So I do think there are gray areas that are probably very minimal, as was mentioned, even in that scenario. So I would support the amendment for that very unlikely and small population that exists.
Representative Allard.
Through the chair, Mrs. Mead, how many sex offenders have protective orders currently against other individuals? Do you know
through
about
the chair,
percentage?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, that is not a data point that the court would maintain. When the court issues a protective order, there is not typically a discussion of the victims.
past criminal history, including whether or not he or she would have to register as a sex offender. I would guess that is not very many.
May I, Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Mead on this one again through the chair, only because of the legal part. Thank you, Senator Keel. What is the likelihood of a sex offender recommitting?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, there is mixed information that I'm aware of on that. And I think I would not hazard a guess because I don't have that expertise.
Just one more, if you don't mind. Thank you, and through the chair. So in looking at this amendment, I'm just going to say it. I don't really care what anybody says. I'm not interested in protecting a sex offender, ever. They committed a crime against humanity. They deserve whatever they're getting. And I'm trying to wrap my head around this CS, and in any way, does the CS protect a sex offender if they believe in any way they've been stalked or abused or any way? Just a tiny bit.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I appreciate the fineness with which you answered that question. The CS itself unambiguously says that if you're required to register as a sex offender, we're not going to protect you by hiding your address. The amendment does give an out. It provides that person could get the judge to say, my safety is important here, and I want to have my address hidden from the public. I want to stress that the court is neutral on this. We don't have any position at all. We aren't seeking these hearings. This is this is your policy call. But to answer your question, the amendment would give a potential for somebody to get off that list.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
And I appreciate the indulgence of the committee. We brought this forward just so we could have some policy discussion. I don't want to say it's a little bit of an experiment, but we would like to highlight some of the issues surrounding the bill itself. But I think it's going to be pretty easy for us to get real deep into the weeds, and I don't know how far we want to go. So if we could limit it. Representative Johnson, do you have a comment, question?
So many. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this is for the Department of Law. I hate to play musical chairs. But I too am concerned about it. And the scenario you painted, Senator Keel, of someone who is a sex trafficked individual. So before that person would have to be on the witness or the sexual offender roll, they would have to go to trial. There would have to be a due process. They would be convicted of a crime and then serve some kind of time or not, and then decide they want to get off the offender list. And I just don't see a lot of that. I think that, and this is maybe a question for the court system, I don't see us prosecuting a lot of people who escaped from slavery being tried as sex offenders. And so I think that there's some mitigating circumstances or some things that are involved, coercion, forcedness, that would prohibit them from ever being sentenced or charged with that crime. So to me, that scenario is highly unlikely. I'm tempted to move to table the amendment, but if we want to continue the discussion, I'll yield to the chairman. But I move to table the amendment. I think it's way out of bounds and we shouldn't be protecting criminals.
I definitely appreciate the conversation and the discussion we've had on this. I don't know if I'm going to do another amendment ever again, but a friendly amendment that almost became an unfriendly amendment. But we'll see if we can go a little bit farther on this, and then we'll...
There's the table. There's a motion.
There's a motion table.
No objection.
No objection. Okay. So House records could call roll, please, on the objection. On the table.
Representative Carrick?
No. Sorry.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Representative Carpenter?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Allard?
Yes.
Chair Shaw?
Yes.
Five yeas, two nays.
And with a vote of five yeas and two nays, this amendment has been tabled. Brief at ease. For SB 12, it looks like I have Susie Pearson online for to testify. Would you like to introduce yourself and provide your testimony, please?
Thanks so much to the members of the committee for hearing from me today. My name is Susie Pearson. I'm the Executive Director for Abused Women's Aid in Crisis, or AWAKE, located in Anchorage. AWAKE is the only emergency domestic violence program in Anchorage. I'm calling in support of SB 12, the Address Confidentiality Bill, with the proposed amendment that has been tabled. This bill will protect victims of domestic violence and stalking that are at the highest risk for lethality. Currently, many victims use AWAKE's address as their permanent address in order to avoid getting mail at the place that they are currently residing in order to keep their own location confidential. This practice puts AWAKE at risk when there are participants in high lethality situations. However, how will they be able to obtain critical documents and access rights such as voting without a permanent address? This bill would allow them the protection and protect AWAKE. By supporting SB 12, you'll be supporting victims at high risk, allowing them to apply for the PFD, register to vote, and register with the DMV with safe and secure address. Thanks so much for listening to my testimony and your service to the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. I see we have no one else online. I'd like to open the floor to public testimony. Anyone in the room that would like to testify, please come forward and put your name on the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. For the record, my name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We support Senate Bill 12. Alaska is one of the few states remaining to establish an address confidentiality program. The first program was established back in 1991 by the state of Washington. With so many states using the program for so many years, we know that it's effective and works. Most address confidentiality programs are one tool and part of a larger safety plan. Violence frequently escalates when people who choose to cause harm believe they're losing control of the victim. One of the most dangerous times for victims is when they attempt to leave. They're at much greater risk of serious injury or death. If victims are successful in escaping, the person causing harm will usually focus their energy on finding that person, often searching public records, including voter registration and driver's license rolls. This address confidentiality program will help to keep the victim and their children from being discovered. Will it be used frequently? I think it will be used occasionally when the circumstances are extreme, the danger real, and secrecy is critical to the victim's survival. It isn't something to be taken lightly. All first-class mail delivery will be delayed, which of course is never optimal, but in case these cases are meant to be life-saving. Safety planning will explore the necessity of subscribing to the program and afford the victim an opportunity to balance those potential gains in participating against any detriments. We appreciate the ability given to the department to set standards in addition to protective orders when making enrollment decisions. There are times and situations where protective orders are not in the best interest of the victim, when lethality is particularly high, and providing information through the protective order is considered placing the victim at even greater risk. In such situations, it will be more beneficial to allow the victim to enroll in this address confidentiality program. Thank you for taking public testimony and for your thoughtful consideration in moving the bill forward.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Morton. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, we close public testimony. Any committee members have additional questions for the bill sponsor? Would the bill sponsor like to come forward and do a closing statement?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Jesse Keel, Senate District B. Thank you very much for your committee's careful and thoughtful consideration of the bill. The version that is before you, I think, does an excellent job of protecting the general public, of closing the loophole that was in the bill we brought to you, and I appreciate your consideration of it today.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Representative Wright.
Chair Shaw, I move House State Affairs Committee substitute to Senate Bill 12, Work Order 33LS0162, Hotel, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, and authorize legislative legal to make any necessary technical or conforming changes.
Thank you, Representative Wright. Seeing no objection, Senate Bill 12 moves from committee. I'd like to take a brief at ease to complete the committee report. Sponsored by Representative Galvin. House Resolution 18 was introduced to the committee on February 5th. Today we're going to introduce a committee substitute, take public testimony, and move the bill if it's the will of the committee. Representative Wright, could I have a motion, please?
Chair Shaw, I move committee substitute to House Joint Resolution 18, Work Order 33LS1003, Sierra, as the committee's working document.
Thank you, Representative Wright. I'm going to object for purposes of explanation and discussion. And Buddy Witt, if you're at the table, could you introduce yourself and speak to the legislation, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Chairman Shaw. This was a change brought to us by the bill sponsor, so it was requested by the bill sponsor, and it just cleans up language in the very first whereas. It takes out the existing language, and it replaces it with, whereas many public employees, while employed by the state or political subdivision of the state that participates in the public employees retirement system of Alaska, do not participate in Social Security. And that's just a little bit of a cleanup language there.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, the committee substitute has been adopted. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony, and I'm going to set a time limit, 2 minutes. And I don't see if we have any. See if we have any public testimony. Oh, we have none. Anyone in the room that wants to testify? Nobody. Oh my gosh. It looks like we have a number of people online. I just pulled it up and we'll get started. Kathleen Yerbeck from Wasilla. If you'd like to put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, please.
My name is Kathleen Yerbeck and I'm a teacher in Wasilla. Thank you for your work on HJR 18. I'm hoping your diligence will help repeal this unfair system. My employment with America started when I was 8 years old. I delivered newspapers every morning until I was 16. I was then promoted to flipping burgers at the local restaurant. I graduated and joined the United States Navy and stayed for 10 years. My Social Security account was increasing with each year that I worked. But then, like many women, I wanted to start a family, so I left the workforce for a few years and raised 4 children in Wasilla. When my youngest child entered kindergarten, I re-entered the workforce. I enthusiastically began a teaching career with the Matson School District. 2 years in, I attended an economic seminar. The room was filled with mostly older women. There was an audible gasp in the room when the speaker informed us about the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset. We were told that our monies in our Social Security accounts would be penalized because we are teaching in Alaska. No one knew. Most of the women were moms that had a break in work to raise children. So we never reached the untouchable 30 units for our Social Security accounts not to be penalized. The numbers paint a bleak picture. Because we are working as teachers in Alaska, there will be very little given to me of my Social Security money. Because we are teachers, we will receive very little of our husbands. I have heard many extremely sad stories, mostly from women, that were not aware of the WEP or GPO until they were getting ready to retire. They were devastated. So think about my story. Here you have a citizen that has been working most of her life. Here you have a veteran that served honorably. Here you have a mom that took time to raise her children. Here you have a teacher and a community volunteer that will receive a fraction of her Social Security money. The windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset are pieces of an unfair, archaic system. Thank you for trying to repeal it.
Thank you, Ms. Yerbich. Next, we have Marilyn Pilfont from Anchorage. If you'd like to put yourself on the record, provide your testimony, please.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the House State Affairs Committee. My name is Marilyn Pilfont, and I am testifying on House Joint Resolution 18 as an individual. I wanted to say thank you to Representative Galvin, first of all, for putting forth this resolution and having discussion about the situation with the windfall elimination provision and the Government Pension Offset Act. I would like to encourage all legislators and your committee to move HJR 18 forward to the full House for a vote, hopefully in the positive to pass and move ultimately the resolution to the United States Congress. I listened recently to the Congressional Ways and Means subcommittee hearing, which occurred during the latter part of summer, where several folks testified on this topic. Interestingly enough, all speakers stated they knew nothing of this penalty act until they were ready to retire after decades of public service. Some had to find other jobs to supplement their retirements because their Social Security benefits were cut, diminished, and stolen from them. I, too, as a public elementary school teacher of 28 years, did not know of this punishing legislation until I was retiring. It is quite unfair to learn about this at the end of my career, but just as unfair to take away money I paid into the Social Security system, planning for my retirement, only to be penalized by the WEP GPO. Please rectify this money grab by supporting HJR Community Substitute now, 18. It is imperative that Congress understand the consequences of their uninformed actions. Thank you for listening and your efforts to eliminate this huge problem. And in conclusion, I am additionally hopeful that your committee will hear Senate Bill 88 to restore pensions for public servants. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Pilfont. Sarah Campbell in Ketchikan, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, you have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Campbell, and I'm calling in from Ketchikan, Alaska. I would like to offer my support of HJR 18 and also thank Representative Elise Galvin for introducing this resolution. Lack of a real retirement is a significant issue impacting Alaska public employees. And if not having a real retirement isn't stressful enough, all public employees in our state will also have their Social Security benefits penalized as well. It's a double whammy. I'm encouraged that this committee is taking time to consider this important resolution, as right now, employees in the state of Alaska, our public employees, most dedicated public employees, need to know that their legislatures hear and support them. So urging the federal government to repeal the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset is certainly a step in the right direction. Early on in my teaching career, a colleague who is about to retire told me that because we were teachers, our Social Security benefits would be reduced by about half. It didn't seem fair to me at the time, and honestly, it didn't make much sense since I had paid into Social Security prior to becoming a teacher and was currently paying into Social Security through my part-time jobs that I had to supplement my teaching salary. My husband is also a lifelong Alaskan, and he served for 24 years as an Alaska state trooper. He also worked in the private sector before becoming a state trooper, and he works now after retiring from the troopers. So even though he pays into Social Security, his tenure as a state trooper will result in WEP and GPO reductions. These provisions essentially penalize all public employees in the state of Alaska, which is why they need to be repealed. I'm really concerned also about the GPO, which reduces spousal and survivor benefits. Over 70% of those affected by GPO lose their entire spousal benefit. And some widowed public employees might receive that benefit while they're still working, but the minute they retire and start receiving a pension, they will no longer receive the benefit that their loved one earned.
Ms. Campbell, could you go ahead and complete your testimony, please? 2 minutes.
I can, thank you. I would hope that you would support this resolution, advance it to the next committee, and thank you in the future for supporting Senate Bill 88 to restore a pension for the public employees who serve this state, much like you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. And next we have Natasha Graham from Anchorage. If you'd like to put yourself on the record, provide your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Shaw and members of the House State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Natasha Graham. I was born on Elmendorf, graduated from Seward High and from UAA. I'm the proud mom of three awesome kids. I began my teaching career while a military spouse at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I started working at age 13 in my parents' restaurant in Seward, and for 20 years worked to earn my 40 quarters to be eligible to receive Social Security benefits before I started teaching with the Anchorage School District in 2006. I support this joint resolution that urges Congress to eliminate the WEP WEP GPO provisions of Social Security because as a Tier 3 educator in the teacher retirement system, I will lose more than half of the Social Security benefit I earned as a result of the windfall elimination provision. I work to keep myself fit and healthy so that I can live well into old age. The problem is, without a pension and Social Security, I will run out of money before my body quits. The elimination of WEP and GPO cannot wait, as cannot a hearing for Senate Bill 88. I urge this committee to pass this joint resolution and hold a hearing for SB 88 to ensure that hardworking Alaskans that have served the public have the financial security and retirement that we all deserve. Thank you for your service and for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Linda Sharp in Anchorage, could you put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, please?
Yes, my name is Linda Sharp, and I would like to say that I agree with the previous speakers in many ways. The first one, my situation is almost identical, other than I didn't learn about that windfall until I went to collect my Social Security. So I had no ability to even rethink what I might be doing. And I chose to not collect Social Security until age 69 because I thought that 8% interest was better than I was getting in my checking account or my savings account. And I had to continue working in private industry for other unrelated reasons. I also had my Social Security show up as less than half. So I met with them several times about it and said, how can this be? And they explained to me what I suppose most people on this committee already know and what the other four previous speakers already spoke to. So rather than go into my own situation in any length, I would like to say maybe the legislature could look at funding teachers in a similar way that you did to funding yourself last year when you got a very generous raise and add Social Security plus a decent pension in there. And then you probably would have no problem getting teachers, and you could make it a 25-year bill so people could look at 25 years and count on it, and, you know, people could rethink it later if it was too lucrative for the teachers. So that concludes my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sharp. Pamela Lloyd, calling from Palm Springs, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, please.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon, members of the House State Affairs Committee. My name is Pamela Lloyd, and I do live in Sterling, Alaska. I'm just visiting my sister in Palm Springs. I wanted to offer testimony in support of HJR 18 and thank Representative Elise Galvin for introducing this. As the resolution states, Alaska is the most impacted state in the country for this GPO WEP, with 15.2% of all retired members impacted. And I am one of those. I am impacted. While I'm grateful for my state pension, last year's Social Security withheld $532 a month from my benefits. And this year, they are withholding $587 per month. I find this outrageous. In addition, my husband will not be able to receive any of my Social Security innings that I paid for if I die first. I want to thank you for hearing this resolution. I hope that you will advance it to the next committee. And in addition, I hope that this committee will take up and hear Senate Bill 88 to restore pensions for public service, which is so dearly needed to keep and retain all of us. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Lloyd. We appreciate your testimony. I have no one else online to testify, so we are going to close public testimony. Anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Committee members, have any additional questions for the bill sponsor? Would the bill sponsor like to come forward and make any closing comments?
Just to thank you, Chair Shaw, for hearing this House joint resolution. I don't think I could say it any better than the testimony that we've just heard. But I do greatly appreciate this process, and I appreciate that in Congress we have bipartisan support for this, thank goodness. And I've already sensed that here in the House, and I'm grateful for that. So I look forward to moving this along and ensuring our current public servants that we are speaking up for them, and that our federal delegation is also working on our behalf and listening to elected leaders from this body. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. And I'd like to highlight from my perspective, I am collecting Social Security, and when I came into the Navy in 1968, I was making $98 a month. And I paid Social Security on that, so you can imagine with the Windfall Provisions Act. We're looking forward to it being moved forward. So thank you. Representative Wright.
Chair Shaw, I move House State Affairs Committee substitute to House Joint Resolution 18, Work Order 33 LS 1003 Sierra from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
See, no objection. HJR 18 moves for committee. We'll take a brief at ease to complete the committee report. 95, sponsored by Senator Merrick. It was given an initial introduction on March 5th. Committee members were introduced to the policy and heard from invited testimony. One amendment was received by my office by the amendment deadline, sponsored by Representative Allard. Representative Allard, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, and move amendment number one.
Objection.
Thank you.
Just for purposes of discussion.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion?
Yes. Thank you.
Please.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So I do appreciate this bill coming forward by Senator Merrick. And what I did was did a little bit of research, and Space Force is somebody that needs, or a group of individuals that now need to be recognized. They are part of our armed force. Our armed forces, they fall under Department of Defense, but they also sublay underneath the Air Force, much like the Marines do to the Navy. No offense, buddy. Gotcha. So we have, they participate in every event, in every conflict since Vietnam. Clear Air Force Base was one of five in the world, third that became an Air Force, or a Space Force location. Our Space Force guardians deserve what every other branch receives. Even the Coasties get it, so no offense to the Coasties. We can't do things without them either. So I would hope that you guys would support this amendment in regards, and we have 8,600 members of the Space Force currently. The other portion of the amendment I address with the women veterans. So as of November of 2023, 10,000 women veterans reside in the state of Alaska. We are tied for first with Virginia per capita. So we have the most female veterans. There are 1.6 million or 1.5, depending on your resource of what source you cite, female veterans in the country. 10% overall are female veterans. We have 50.4% of the population in the world. So it is, I do understand that I do need the support of the males on this committee, because we wouldn't be here without you. But we are here, and I would like to ask for this amendment to pass to support the women veterans. But I'd also like to add that I did do a recommendation for a commission or a committee for women veterans to be able to design their own female veteran plates.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. I'm inclined to support this legislation just simply because I do have legislation to put the Space Force into Alaska State statute. But I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor on what their thoughts are.
Representative Merrick, staff, I'd like to come forward, put yourself on the record, and us with those questions and provide our testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Shaw, for the record. Kelly Merrick, I'm Senator for District L. And through the chair to Representative Wright, I actually, and this in no way diminishes women's veterans or the Space Force, but Amendment Number 1 to Senate Bill 95 is completely contrary to the point of this bill. SB 95 was written so that we could eliminate the legislature needing to pass legislation in order for specialty plates to be made. I did support adding the extra plate for the fallen peace officers just because that bill had been introduced prior to my bill being introduced. And so adding more plates to this bill will, if we add three more plates, that will quadruple the fiscal note, probably $14,000 for each of those. And where if you pass this bill, it does not eliminate the opportunity for the Space Force or the women's veterans to get a specialty plate. They will just go through the DMV as opposed to having to be part of a bill.
Thank you, Representative Merrick. Representative Eller.
I would disagree with our Senator Merrick to marginalize female veterans in our state and across the country and marginalize the Space Force is alarming. I live in the district with the most female veterans and military veterans in the entire state of Alaska. This bill does stop us from continuing to do plates, but if we're going to honor those who need to be honored and sacrifice their lives and who have done amazing things for our country, to marginalize the importance just over $14,000 each, well, I just don't agree with that. So I hope I have your support to pass this amendment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Story.
Through the chair, just point of clarification, this bill doesn't stop other groups from getting plates. It just they have to go through the DMV themselves if they would like to get plates. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Story, that is correct. So if there was a group of women veterans that wanted to be recognized, they could put a committee together and then come to the DMV and submit an application. And there is also the opportunity, should the DMV reject that application, they still have an opportunity to come to the legislature. It doesn't stop the legislature from passing license plate bills. It just says that we don't have to do that anymore, that it's now part of the department's responsibility. But should a member of this committee want to bring a bill before you that registers plates for those organizations, they are more than able to do that.
Thank you. Representative Garrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to Senator Merrick. In the other body, it was my understanding that the specialty registration plates for peace officers killed in the line of duty was added. And what was your perspective when that amendment was added on the Senate side?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, that bill was it was introduced before SB 95, but it was in the Senate Finance Committee, and then it was added as a floor amendment. And so there was some disagreement about the procedure with some of the members, but I didn't object to it because it had previously been filed, and I thought it reasonable to include that.
Follow up. Through the chair. However, had that not been included in the other body, this legislation, the license plate bill to end license plate bills, it could have still been pursued by the DMV had it not been added to this bill.
Correct.
And just another follow-up through the chair. And this amendment and the plates that we would be adding here, do you have any objection to those plates or just the process, which we're providing a process for in this legislation?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I in no way would like to diminish the importance of the Space Force or the women's veterans. It's just that this kind of defeats the purpose of the bill
is to make it so that we don't have to do this and that the costs will not be using general fund dollars. As we all know that we're in a fiscal crisis and we're trying to save money where we can.
Just final follow-up.
Final follow-up.
Through the chair to Senator Merrick. Every time the legislature has added a statute for a new license plate bill in the past, it has a cost. And what is the average cost for adding these plates per statute?
Thank you. Through the chair, may I have my staff answer that?
Please.
For the record, Kerry Crocker, staff to Senator Merrick. I did some research. It varies from legislature to legislature. I've seen zero fiscal notes, and I've seen them all the way up to 16,000. So I went back 8 years.
Thank you. Any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, Representative Wright, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
And with that, House Records, could you do a roll call, please, on the amendment?
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Pass.
Representative Carpenter. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Chair Shaw.
Yes.
So 5 yeas, 1 nay.
And with that, Amendment 1 has been adopted. Let's see. I'm going to open for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. There's no one online wishing to testify, so I'm going to close public testimony. Committee members have any additional questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Merrick, do you have any brief wrap-ups or comments you'd like to make?
Thank you, Chair Shaw. I appreciate the conversation and that you heard SB 95 today, and I just appreciate the committee's indulgence.
Thank you very much, Senator Merrick. Representative Wright, what's the will of the committee?
Chair Shaw, I move Senate Bill 95, Work Order 33, LS-0517, Bravo Alpha, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Thank you, Representative Wright. Seeing no objection, Senate Bill 95 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to complete the committee report. Thank you, Senator Merrick. Go back on the record and do a backtrack on a follow-up on Senate Bill 95. Representative Wright?
Chair, sir, I'd like to correct my previous motion for Work Order 33 LS-0517 Bravo Alpha. There is an attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Representative Wright. And with that, we are going to move on to House Bill 190. House Bill 190 is the Alaska Sunset Commission, sponsored by Representative Carpenter. This is the bill's first hearing in the House State Affairs Committee. Today, the committee will hear an introduction, answer committee members' questions, and take public testimony. Representative Carpenter, you guys are already up there. Would you please introduce yourself and provide your testimony?
For the record, I'm Representative Carpenter. I represent District 8, Northern Kenai Peninsula, and my staff.
Through the chair, Kendra Broussard, staff to Representative Carpenter.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for scheduling this bill. And Mr. Chair, I will provide some comments, and then we'll go through sectional analysis, and we have some slides that we'd like to run through. So the reason that I'm bringing the Sunset Commission bill forward is because it is a way to disrupt what we've normally been doing, business as usual, for years within the state, to get at better government. As those who have been in the legislature for a while or served in government for any length of time know, that our day-to-day operations are so busy and focused on the immediate need and mission that it is difficult for individuals in an organization to look at actual process improvement and improving the organization. some, if you think about it from a department perspective, some departments are better than others at improving their operations. And that's largely a function of leadership and experience, training, things like that. For the length of time that I've been in the legislature, I recognize that there is quite a bit of improvement that could be made within state government to be more efficient and therefore less costly. But getting to that is very difficult for us as members of the legislature because we've got a short period of time and a lot of different competing interests. Plus, largely speaking, skill sets of individual legislators don't lend us to making in-depth analysis of organizational improvement. We try to avoid deep conversations about budget cuts because it's painful. And that, when we're talking about government improvement or improving efficiency or reducing spending, is really what it just boils down to when we have conversations is cut versus don't cut or raise taxes, and those are our options. Well, in order to get better government, we have to transcend past that conversation of just do we put more or less dollars towards a problem and start digging down into root causes of problems to find an actual solution that is not just money focused, because many times it's not just money focused. So bringing in the Sunset Commission bill would establish an agency, an entity, a commission made up of appointed members of the public, supported by subject matter experts that are hired as staff to take a look and a deep dive down into each one of our departments in order to provide recommendations to the legislature for statutory change or provide recommendations to the administration for regulatory change that would improve the function of that entity. And when I say entity, I'm using that as in a general sense. It is the department and any sub organization within that department. This would occur throughout the year, not just during a legislative session, and it wouldn't be related to what we do during a legislative session. So those commissioners and the staff that are hired would, throughout the year and throughout a decade, look at the entirety of the state government through the lens of improving the outcomes of state government. And those recommendations would then have to be acted upon by the legislature and by the executive, or, and that's why it's called a sunset commission, that entity would sunset. And maybe that entity doesn't need to sunset. The provision is just to force the government, us and the executive, to come back and say, hey, we recognize that the statute says this is going to sunset. We need to address what the recommendations are from this commission in order to prevent the entity from sunsetting. So it's just putting teeth in and forcing the legislature and the executive to focus on the recommendations provided. So that, in a nutshell, is why and what the Sunset Commission would do. And I will, for a little bit more specifics, I'm going to let my staff run through a sectional analysis.
Through the chair, for the record, Kendra Broussard here. I will go ahead and read the sectional analysis. So Section 1 amends criminal law by allowing persons who hinder the work of the Alaska Sunset Commission to be fined, like those who may hinder the work of the Legislative Audit and Budget Committee. Section 2 through 5 amends the State Personnel Act to include the Alaska Sunset Commission. Section 2 is a person who has been convicted under Section 1 of this act cannot be appointed to state services unless a waiver is granted by the Commissioner of Administration. Section 3 makes public information that a state employee has been dismissed or disciplined for a violation of interference or failure to cooperate with the Alaska Sunset Commission. Section 4 allows a state employee to be disciplined or dismissed for failure to give full cooperation to the Alaska Sunset Commission. Section 5 makes interference or failure to cooperate with the Alaska Sunset Commission a matter of public concern. Section 6 amends the Public Record Disclosure Act to add the Alaska Sunset Commission to the definition of public agency. Section 7 adds a new section of law to establish the Alaska Sunset Commission under the Lieutenant Governor. The commission consists of 7 public members, appointed by the governor, which would be 3, the speaker would be 2, and the Senate president 2, for staggered 5-year terms. It also establishes the qualifications of appointed members, selection of a chair, allows the commission to employ staff, and hire consultants. Commissioners will receive per diem and travel expenses. It also provides the powers and duties of the commission, including reviewing the activities of each state entity, subject to the commission review state entities and make recommendations to the legislature. Prior to the commission's review of an entity, each state entity shall provide to the legislature a report of the entity's evaluation of its adherence to the criteria for the commission's review under this act. Section 7 also provides for the commission to review at least one principal department and its entities each year. Principal departments include state departments and the University of Alaska. The entities of each principal department are the divisions and corporations under each. Section 7 also provides the criteria for review, including the adherence to performance requirements set under the Executive Budget Act, alternative methods for delivery of services, organizational processes, efficiency in which the entity operates, reorganization potential, and the extent to which statutory changes are necessary for the entity to meet the desired improvements. Section 7 also requires the commission to hold public hearings and accept public testimony. At least one public hearing on an entity must be on the interconnected road system. Section 7 requires a report by the commission following each review of a state entity with a recommendation to the legislature to continue, discontinue, restructure, or transfer the duties and programs of the entity, and a recommendation on a winding down period for the entity to conclude its business or provide for a restructuring plan. The commission shall include in the report draft legislation to implement the recommendations of the commission with the request to the Rules Committee to submit the legislation for introduction. Section 7 provides that if the recommendations of the commission are not implemented by law, the entity subject to review will be sunset on June 30th of the fiscal year following the review. And then at the end, it also provides definitions.
Thank you. We also have Kelly Howell, for Chief of Staff for the Lieutenant Governor's Office, online. Are there any questions to the sponsor or Ms. Howell regarding House Bill 190? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. And I don't know if we should do the PowerPoint first, if that might answer some questions.
Mr. Chairman,
or
if you'd like.
If you might, if we can step through this, that might answer some questions, okay. And then we can do questions after.
Okay. Not a problem, please.
Very good.
All right. I will go through the slideshow as well. So how the Alaska Sunset Commission will work. The sunset shines a light on state agencies and programs to see if they are still relevant in a changing world. If the answer is yes, the sunset recommends improvements to make them more effective and efficient. If the answer is no, the sunset recommends abolishing the agency or transferring its functions to another agency with related functions. The commission would be administratively housed under the Lieutenant Governor. Commissioners will be appointed by the governor, speaker, and Senate president. The commission shall be proficient in financial management, business operations, budgeting economics, process improvement, or government efficiency. The commission may hire staff and consultants with similar proficiencies to conduct a review of each entity of a department. HB 190 would require the commission to hold public hearings, at least one on the road system, for each entity reviewed. The commission drafts legislation that must be acted upon or the entity will sunset. Sunset staff evaluation. Each year, the commission will review one state department and each of its entities, divisions, and corporations. Sunset staff will perform extensive research and analysis to evaluate the need for performance for, and improvements to the entity under review. The Sunset Commission staff reviews the agency self-evaluation report, receives input from interested parties, evaluates entity and identifies problems, develops recommendations, and publishes staff reports. the Sunset Commission deliberation. The Sunset Commission conducts a public hearing to take testimony on the staff report and the agency overall. The Sunset Commission conducts a second meeting to vote on which changes to recommend to the legislature. So they'll have public hearings. So Sunset staff presents its reports and recommendations. The agency presents its response. The Sunset Commission will hear public testimony and receive written comments. It will meet again to consider and vote on recommendations. They'll have public input, is published on the website. The Sunset Bill will go through the normal legislative process. So for the legislative action, the Sunset Bill on the entity is drafted and submitted through the Rules Committee. The legislature will consider the Sunset Commission's recommendations and make its final decisions. The Senate and the House conduct committee hearings and debate or amend the bill. The bill passes or fails adoption. If the legislature fails to adopt or act on a bill, the entity sunsets at the end of the following fiscal year. The sunset process is a key legislative oversight tool that significantly streamlined and improved Texas government. So this HB 190 is modeled after the Texas Sunset Commission. The sunset promotes a culture of continuous improvement in state government by providing objective, nonpartisan public forum for evaluating the need for state agencies and their effectiveness, efficiency, and responsiveness to the republic, to the public.
And the republic.
And the republic.
As it's in Texas. Yes. And I just wanted to note there, too, that this isn't something that's brand new. It's been functioning in Texas since 1977.
The Sunset Commission in the 88th legislature of the Texas legislature reviewed 21 entities, resulting in 235 recommendations to streamline state government while enhancing services to our citizens. Generally, the recommendations eliminate unnecessary regulations and improve accountability, align agencies' procedures with best practices, and strengthen effective delivery of services to Texans. The Texas Sunset process has led to major policy changes in almost every area of state government. Sunset recommendations also have eliminated duplication among agencies and programs, increased public participation, helped with government accountability, and improved the quality and efficiency of government services. So the Sunset's impact since 1977. It has streamlined Texas government. 42 entities and programs have been abolished. 52 entities and programs have been abolished and transferred or consolidated. It saved taxpayer money, $1 billion in state and federal savings and revenue gains. Return of $18 for every $1 appropriated to the Sunset Commission since 1985. Has provided effective oversight. 570 reviews of state agencies and programs conducted. 80% of sunset recommendations to the legislature have become state law since 2001.
And I would just like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that slide encompasses a whole lot of change that has happened over a significant period of time. And Texas still has a government. It still has a budget. It is still servicing the needs of Texans. It's just doing it more efficiently.
So the state of Alaska, the state of Alaska department entities has a total of 180. So we have quite a few. So, and
then, the entities here are listed are not just a department, but the subunits of each one of those departments that would be considered entities, just for reference. And the number after each one of them is the numbers that you would find within each one of the departments.
And there's a couple of helpful links on the presentation if you want to do some more research as well. And then we'll open for questions.
All right.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Chairman, let's do questions.
After the presentation, do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw, and thank you, Rep. Carpenter, for bringing this forward. I was wondering how our current audits fit into this process, because we get the audits and they have recommendations. And do you see this as in place of an audit? If you could elaborate, please.
Very good question. Through the chair to Representative Story. No, it's not in place of an audit. our audits that are conducted for either purposes of somebody's identified something that needs to be audited or statutorily required audits, such as sunset audits that are for boards and commissions that we have currently, provide recommendations to the legislature that are purely recommendations. And they have, there's no teeth, there's no requirement for the legislature or the executive branch to act upon those audits. It is, the legislature has hired an auditor, a state auditor, to serve as that objective oversight piece, but there's nothing that forces the legislature to take action on those audits. And so the difference between what we have now within our audit, our state auditor, and a sunset commission would be an entity that is outside of both legislative and executive branch purview, right? So this is, sorry, say executive branch, outside of the departments and the legislature. The sunset commission would be housed underneath the lieutenant governor, who coincidentally has a responsibility for regulatory review currently. This kind of fit within the concept of regulatory review. And so that entity would exist outside of both of those administration or legislative operations, if you will, complementary to legislative audit, not replacing it.
Follow up?
Yes. At the very beginning, you talked about how there were penalties if people didn't cooperate with the commission. And I'm wondering, is that in the audit right now, if people don't cooperate with the auditor, or is that just a model after Texas?
That's a good question. Do you have any input on that?
I do. For the record, Donna Ardwin, staff to Representative Carpenter. Through the chair, Representative Story. This language is directly amends the language for the legislative auditor right now. So the cooperation that's required of state staff, their cooperation to the legislative auditor is mirrored in this legislation.
Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
You almost got off the hook, Mr. Chair.
He's not on the hook. It's me over here.
I'll put you on the hook through the chair to Representative Carpenter. So often an audit or other review provides multiple recommendations. They usually do. And we're seeing that in the legislation on slide 5. You mentioned 235 recommendations in the 88th legislative session in Texas. Some of the recommendations we see in Alaska can be pretty nebulous and perhaps impossible to easily act upon, or difficult to take all the suggestions that could be offered up during one legislative proceeding. So is the intent of the legislation that should our legislature not be able to act on all of the potential recommendations that would come forward, that the whole agency would sunset?
No, and I think that the language, sorry, through the chair to Representative Carrick, Representative Carpenter sitting on the opposite side of the chair for answering questions. If I'm not mistaken, the language in the bill is substantially comply with the recommendations, and therefore there would be a judgment call as to how many actual of the components would have to be taken up, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be all of them if the legislature disagrees, but it would have to be substantially complied with. Do you have anything to add?
I would like to add, through the chair, Representative Carrick, Donna Ardwin for the record, the legislation requires a report on each entity, so that would be a division or a corporation, a sub-entity of a department to be given to you. They don't have to provide you a report on each of those entities. If they do, each entity comes with a piece of legislation. If that legislation is not acted on, it could require process improvements. It could require reorganization, and the legislature can amend it. But if you don't act on that legislation, then that entity, which could be just one division or one corporation, is sunset the following year.
Follow up? Through the chair to Representative Carpenter or staff. And I understand the intent is to provide information about efficacy, effectiveness, efficiency of state government. What happens if the Sunset Commission in their process finds that an agency or an entity is operating inefficiently because of a lack of resources, as opposed to just duplication of services?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, that's a great question. I would assume that if we're talking about resources as in dollars, and that is what the commission finds is the thing that's causing the problem, then the recommendation to the legislature would be to increase funding to alleviate that problem.
And just a quick follow-up to that. Please. So through the chair, if the legislature were then to get a recommendation to increase funding for an agent, for an entity, and did not take action, what would be the next thing that would happen? Let's say the state doesn't have the money to afford the necessary resources to make that agency operate more efficiently per the Sunset Commission's recommendation.
So if there's a through the chair to Representative Carrick, if there is a recommendation that is not followed, they just ignore it, then that entity would sunset. So the legislature is forced to have a conversation about what it does, how it is going to respond to the report. So if the report is for $1 million, I'm just hypothetically speaking here, if it's for $1 million in funding or an additional 10 employees, and the legislature says, hey, you know what, we're going to address this, and we address it with $500,000 or 5 additional employees instead of meeting the total recommendation, then substantially they've complied with the recommendation to increase, but they're exercising the legislative authority to, you know, control the purse and have the discretion as to whether how much to address it. So I hope that answers your question, that this isn't supposed to alleviate or reduce the authority of the legislature to be able to decide what is the appropriate response. There's just a recommendation and a requirement to act in some manner on that recommendation. Do you have anything to add?
Just want to add, Representative Carpenter, through the chair, Representative Carrick. The Sunset Commission is required to submit a report on the entities that they've evaluated, including, you can see the details in the bill, but including all of the public testimony that they've taken, other input, all of their work with the state agencies and so forth. They're not required to submit a piece of legislation for everything that's in that report. Mm-hmm. Some of it may be a report to you making recommendations for additional funding. So if your question is, would a recommendation for additional funding being ignored cause the entire entity to sunset, that's not the way this is designed. It's designed to give you a report about they need more staff in order to get this done, for example, that won't necessarily have a piece of statute to go with it unless a piece of statute is necessary.
Any additional questions from committee members? Representative Carpenter, I have one. And looking on slide 10, the department entities, I notice you don't have the governor's office, lieutenant governor's office, or the legislature listed. Is there a reason the Sunset Commission wouldn't have any of those on board for any reason one way or the other?
Thanks for the question. I'm not entirely sure. I'm going to take a lifeline to see if we've got a better answer than off the top of my head.
There is, through the chair, Donna Ardwin, Chairman Shaw, there is a separation of powers issue with reviewing the governor's office per se.
But, Mr. Chairman, if we wanted to include ourselves in the sunset provision, I would be supportive of that friendly amendment.
No more friendly amendments for me. But thank you. I knew there'd be an answer out there somewhere. You know, the benefit of having good staff is they give you good direction. So additional questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Carpenter, how did Texas deal with the collective bargaining if they found someone who was interfering with it and were terminated, yet they under a contract? How did they deal with that aspect of it, or did they?
That's a good question, and if my staff doesn't have an answer, I'll have to do some research and get back to you.
Okay. Yeah. And one,
yes, sir.
One other question. I can see this turning political very fast with the way the appointments and the turnover. Have you given any consideration to, and I'll give you an example, the personnel board who deals with ethics for the governor and the lieutenant governor and the AG cannot be terminated because they deal with, you know, they want to have a ruling and the governor decides you're fired. Have you given any thought to putting any kind of safeguards in there to keep the commission in place so that they don't have to worry about political? Now, they'll still have to go for reappointment and all that. But have you given any consideration for protecting those people? So you don't want to have halfway through it or some department finds that they don't like what's going on and they replace two, or the House replaces two, or the Senate replaces two. Have you given any thought to maybe protecting that so that they can have certain assurances that midterm they're not going to recommend something that would be politically unpalatable to a department and therefore lose their position on the commission?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson. So as currently drafted, the terms for the commission, the appointed commissioners, is 5-year terms. If the question you're asking, if I understand correctly, is how do we prevent a commissioner from being replaced by another commissioner? And I'm not sure that the statute as drafted allows for it to be replaced. They are appointed for a 5-year term, and therefore they serve their 5-year term as opposed to serving at the pleasure of the executive. And this isn't just the executive that appoints them. The executive has 3. The legislature has 4, split between the House and the Senate.
We're good. Okay. Follow up?
To kind of get that on the record, because okay. I could see that turning political very fast. So I just wanted to make sure that the commission's not doing what we want, so we're going to get
right
4 or 5 more commissioners. So I just want to put that on the record. And if it's not clear in the bill, I'd like to address that. So okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. If I can respond briefly to that, I would assume that there have been many conversations that have happened in Texas since 1977 in regards to the recommendations from the Sunset Commission that have been political and have become political, and they've somehow worked through it to continue to function. So
thank you, Representative Carpenter. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. Through the chair, I should say to Rep. Carpenter, the University of Alaska is on here, and I'd be curious how the University of Texas system has worked this out, because I'm assuming they're on their review list too, because I know the university goes through accreditation. They have to meet certain requirements, have to have certain evaluations in order to keep in order to provide an education that we know is certified. And how has that worked out?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I know that there are some case studies that have been published regarding the efforts made by the Texas Sunset Commission. The links provided would probably point us in that direction. Off the top of my head, I can't speak to how their university system fared underneath that, but I can do a little bit of research and get back to you.
Thank you. For any additional questions? Seeing none. We're going to open for public testimony. I don't see anybody online. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide testimony? Seeing none, close public testimony. Any additional comments or questions from the committee? Seeing none. Do committee members have any additional comments? I don't hear any. Seeing no other questions or comments from committee members, we'll set the bill aside for additional work. Amendments for House Bill 190 are due to my office by close of business Friday, March 15th, which is day 60. And without any additional comments, no other business before the committee, we are adjourned at 4:55. Thank you.